weirdly, unlike Hardy, who famously said that the response to Jude cured him of novel writing for good, I emerged feeling more confident than ever as a result of some of the stick that I'd taken.
Welcome to another episode of In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. I'm back after a little mid-season break last week, and the voice that you just heard was that of the author Jeff Dyer. Jeff was born in Cheltenham in England, but he now spends most of his time in Los Angeles, where he teaches at the University of Southern California, and that's where he was when we recorded this conversation remotely in January. It's hard to explain exactly what kind of writer Jeff is, and I think that's quite deliberate. Sometimes he's a novelist, sometimes he's a critic, sometimes he's a memoirist, but often there are elements of all of these things in his work. And although I would say that he's an intellectual writer, he's also very, very funny, as you'll hear. He's published four novels, including Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi, and he once described himself as the author of many non-fiction books which are full of invention. Some of his most popular non-fiction titles include 1997's Out of Sheer Rage, which is a hilarious account of his own attempts to write a book about D.H. Lawrence. Steve Martin described that one as the funniest book I have ever read. There's also 2003's Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It, and Jeff's most recent book, The Last Days of Roger Federer and Other Endings. That one came out in 2022, and it's a study of how people manage the final years of their working life, which is something that we'll talk about a little bit in this interview. We also discuss what he's got against moleskin notebooks, how the boringness of his first published book spurred him on to find a better, more natural voice, and why he used to find cannabis and LSD useful creative tools. Before we get started, as you know, this season of In Writing is sponsored by Curtis Brown Creative, the renowned writing school run by the Literary and Talent Agency. They launched in 2011, and since then, over 180 of their students have gone on to get major book deals, including critically acclaimed authors Bonnie Garmus, Jane Harper, and Kirsty Capes. Curtis Brown Creative offers a wide range of online writing courses designed to help you no matter what your current skill level is. People who are just getting started might want to try the four-week Creative Writing for Beginners course. It's led by the author and founder of CBC, Anna Davis. It's designed to unleash your imagination, give you the confidence to put pen to paper, and get you working on your own creation. Plus, all students have the opportunity to get feedback from one of CBC's fiction editors. Curtis Brown Creative have provided an exclusive discount for listeners to this podcast. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the full price of Creative Writing for Beginners or any other 4 or 6 week online course. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. I'll be back at the end of this episode, but for now, over to Jeff. So are you in the room where you write, usually?
I don't really have a proper room. Here in Los Angeles, I've just got this little, my wife and I call it a nook. It's not a room, it's not a study. It's completely inappropriate for a man of my age and eminence. So I'm just crammed into this little, that's all I can call it, a nook really. And it's, I'm just in my nook, you know. Thought I might have graduated to a better writing environment at this stage, but no, if anything, I seem to have been downgraded.
I know. I was thinking today about there's a bit in Out of Sheer Rage where you talk about ideal places for working and how our sort of idea of what would be a wonderful place to work is generally actually somewhere where you would get no work done whatsoever. You know, like sitting in a chair looking at a beautiful view of, you know, the Italian hills or whatever. Is your workplace somewhere that I would think looked like an ideal place for working, or not so much?
Let's unpack the question a bit. What I should say is that I had a lovely study in London, and at some point I'll be back there, and that's the classic book line study, and that really is an ideal place to work. Not because of the view, there's a view from the window, but it's facing in such a way that the sun comes in, so we have to keep the blind down. So, you know, if it's not one thing or another. But what I really am aware of in that book-lined study is just how perfect the acoustic is. As soon as you go into that room, there's a kind of an acoustic that's gently conducive to concentrating. So I like that very much. But
how would you define an acoustic that's conducive to concentrating?
Here in Los Angeles, it's a kind of loft thing, and it's the most horrible kind of acoustic. It's all metal, glass, and concrete, so it's very, very clangy. I would describe that as a nerve-shredding acoustic. So if we have if there's any number of people here, it's just so sort of jangly. Whereas an acoustic that has that's formed by lots of books, then that's just a comfortable acoustic, really. And I guess the combination of the sight of the books and the acoustic they create means that you're there to do book stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
But my main point, though, is that I have really no patience at all with people who are, I have no patience with myself when I get fussy about conditions, because it's always been a belief of mine that one of the great things about the writing life is that you can really do it anywhere. All you need is a table, a chair, and a reasonable amount of quiet. I guess you need an internet connection now to look things up. But yeah, as long as you've got that, you can really do it anywhere, and all the difficulties are actually in your head. And it's almost a point of principle on my part that one shouldn't be too precious or fussy about conditions being met. They nearly always end up being excuses. As long as you've had enough sleep, it seems to me you can do it anywhere.
Yeah. Would you describe for us, sort of paint a picture of this nook and what you're looking at when you're sitting at your desk or table?
Sure thing. So we've got this kind of loft thing, and I'm upstairs in this sort of cordoned off bit. It's very, very small. And behind me, I've got a few books, not very many. And then, as I'm sure you're aware, it's been so incredibly rainy in California that I've got a truly dismal view in front of me of all the things we've had to bring in from the terrace to keep them dry from the relentless onslaught of storms. And then to my left, the sun is out again today, as it's meant to be every day in California. The sun's out, but the sun is so bright that the blind is down, so all I see is a kind of hazy view of the terrace in the middle distance, some palm trees, and way off in the distance, it's actually a very clear day, I can see the snow-capped mountains. But the thing is, all of that is irrelevant. The only thing that is that matters is, of course, what's going on in front of you.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there's anything in there that you consider important, you know, any objects that really mean a lot to you around your desk, but it sounds as though really the only thing that matters is the document you're working on.
Yeah, that's right. At the moment, or as Alan Shearer likes to say, at the present moment in time, I do have a few things on my desk. I mean, because I'm writing this book about my childhood, which is taking the form of a map, I've got this old A to Z street plan of Cheltenham, and it dates from the 1970s. I mean, obviously the streets haven't changed that much. A few new ones have been built. But I've got that I need for reference. And then I've got a little... I'm so hostile to this kind of whole cult of the moleskin book, you know, as popularized by Hemingway and Bruce Chatwin. Bruce Chatwin, whose writing I've never been able to bear. So it's always been another principle of mine, that I always have the cheapest kind of stationery that you can get, either from Ryman's, and I've got this Ryman's book here that I make notes to myself in, and they're always just prompts or just things to remind myself. And then there's a few other little notebooks which I've got from Staples, a sort of budget stationers here. But it's all it's all just very basic stuff. There's no brand, no expensively branded stationery.
I here. Quite agree with you on that. I'm just looking at my own notebook to see where it was from, but it's a very, very cheap looking ring bound thing that I can just tear pages out of. I mean, I don't know why you would need anything else.
Quite right. We're at one. That's what you need. You need a ring-bound little notebook so you can tear pages out when you've finished transcribing them.
Yeah.
But actually, since I'm always trying to get stuff for free, let's have a big shout-out for Ryman's. What a great stationery store that is. So if they're listening, I'm very ready to become a Ryman's brand ambassador.
Yeah, so your next book could be sponsored by Ryman's. Yeah, that would be a great career twist.
This is the kind of low life level of operations that I've been reduced to, pitching Ryman's for a sponsorship deal.
So you're working on a book about your childhood. That's exciting to hear. When you are working on a book, what's your sort of routine, if there is one, in terms of your writing?
Yeah, I guess there is a routine that I recognise now, which is, I finished the Roger Federer book a while back, and I was so ecstatically happy during the last 6 months of writing that, and I was putting in these, putting in long hours at it, and it wasn't requiring any self-discipline on my part. It was all I wanted to do. So two Christmases ago, I remember on Christmas Day at about 3 o'clock, my wife came up and said, "I've put on my Christmas Day sweater. Are you not coming down at all?" And I did go down so we could have some sort of Christmas at that point. But for me, it was just another day, and I was up here writing away quite happily. And I was the thing to emphasise is that I really was so happy, and I made a resolution that for once I would do what I've never been able to done before, which is as soon as I'd finished this book, I would go straight on to the Cheltenham childhood book without a pause, the way that career writers tend to. They'll maybe have a weekend off between books or something. And I thought, I'm going to do this time. And, so there are certain extreme versions of that. I can think of Larry McMurtry, who I think maybe had about an hour off between finishing one book and starting another. Anyway, so that was my resolution because, and in fact, then I failed to keep it and fell into my normal pattern, which is always to just do nothing and then become rather depressed as a result of doing nothing. And so I wasted a lot of time before I properly got going on this Cheltenham book. And even now, the contrast between those effortlessly long shifts, as it were, that I could put in towards the end of the Federer book and the kind of concentration I can muster now is considerable. And I recognise this from previous things, but gradually I would say two things are going on. One, the length of time I'm able to concentrate on this new book is increasing, and the amount of will that I'm needing to draw on in order to get going on it is reducing.
So that's great.
I feel already at this early stage maybe the worst is over, and the worst was just this year where I spent doing almost nothing, just foolishly squandering my time.
That's fantastic, because I think what I hear from a lot of writers is almost the opposite of that they feel very enthusiastic at the beginning and then sort of get somewhere into the middle and have a complete crisis of confidence about the whole idea and then start really dragging their feet. But it sounds as though for you, you gain momentum and enthusiasm as you get deeper into it.
Yes, I think that's true, with sort of ups and downs, but gradually that's the case. And nearly all, I mean, there's, I'm at a quite a significant phase with this book, one that I'm kind of slightly wary of it, in that I did fail a few years, several years ago now, time flies, to write a book about tennis. And one of the reasons I failed to write that book is because I generated a chaotic mass of material, and then two things went wrong. One, I was unable to find a form that I thought would be appropriate to the subject, tennis. And also I just got the sort of compost heap of material just became, I just couldn't find a way of managing it. And I'm at a quite precarious point with this new book now, where there's a lot of material, which is reassuring because, you know, better that than the blank page. But I slightly feel that I could be teetering on the brink of it becoming unmanageable. But I think it is just about manageable, and I'm getting the sense now of being able to put it together. And if my prior experience is anything to go by, the stage of real, you know, when it's really happening will be when I'm able to have both the entire book in my head and be able to get into the individual bits of it. Anyway, it's a real sort of balancing act, that. But the key thing to be said, of course, is that, you know, there's so many different ways to skin this cat, and you could speak to you could speak to 1,000 writers, and each one would have a different way of doing it, a way that worked for them, but would be absolutely terrible for someone else.
Yeah, I think that's quite an encouraging thought, really, in that, you know, sometimes I think we can get a bit bogged down in the idea that there's a right and a wrong way of doing it, and we might be doing it the wrong way, whereas actually I think generally you can find your way through whichever way feels best, you know, in the moment. But
yeah, and one of the sort of weird bits of self-discipline that I've needed to acquire is the capacity to not fall into complete despair during these long interludes when I'm not doing anything. The instinct is, of course, to think, oh my God, I'm finished, I can't do it anymore. Yeah. But then I'm so familiar with that feeling that I'm able to sort of ride it out in a state of not contentment, but not falling into a kind of into total despair, because I recognize now that for me, and again it's just for me, not for everyone else, this is maybe part of the process. In my case, it's the problem is, I mean, it seems to me you can do that thing of finishing a book on the Friday, having the weekend off and starting a new one, if you're really writing books that are formally the same, you know. Mm. I mean, especially if you've got sort of recurring characters and you're writing, you know, volume 8 of A Dance to the Music of Time or whatever, then it's a continual thing. Whereas for me, there has to be this, each book is it's often about something completely different to the previous one. And crucially, it has a form which is uniquely appropriate to that subject. So I would almost go so far as to say this period of not doing anything is a necessary part of decompression, as it were, so that I can start over with what is genuinely a new book in a new form, as opposed to just doing an update of the previous book or another book in that sequence.
Yeah. My next question is maybe particularly appropriate because of what you're working on, but when do you first remember being interested in writing as a child, I suppose?
Yeah, I guess I did do a few little bits of writing as a kid. You know, I was born in 1958, so my childhood was drenched in the Second World War, and I think I wrote a few little war things as a kid. But then, I mean, I didn't really get interested in literature till O levels at school. And then there was university, and it was really, I mean, I would tend to ignore those youthful things. And it was not until after university in my 20s that I started to, you know, to think that I could write something that might be, that other people might want to read.
Yeah, I know. You've talked a lot about those years and how you left Oxford and came to London and claimed the dole for a while. And
great, yeah.
At what point did you start earning a living from writing, and how did you start to earn a living from writing?
Yeah, I mean, yes. Let's acknowledge the help of the government. And as many people of my age have said, you know, it was a really recognized way of surviving. And I think it was Roland Gift from the Fine Young Cannibals who said, you know, people of a different generation need to realize that the dole supported a whole generation of artists, writers, dancers, musicians,
yes,
this kind of thing. And then, I mean, what happened was that I started, the first things I published were book reviews. And that was an important thing because then I started getting books for free. And, you know, that was a major part of my expenditure. So that was important. And there was this brief period where I was getting a bit of money from various sort of sources. And there came a point when I, you know, reluctantly weaned myself off the dole. But the key thing to say is that those early years of just beginning writing and not getting any money for it, and also those years of reading a lot after university, that really wouldn't have been possible without the dole. And of course, now I teach in America, and I'm very conscious that, I was really conscious when I was in Iowa and Texas teaching on the MFA programs there, that I was very happy in these places. And I was very conscious that in their way, the people who'd got onto these very elite MFA programs, because you're fully funded for 3 or 4 years, I was struck by the way their lives were, if you like, and they were sort of institutionally respectable versions of exactly the life I was living on the dole, that is to say, with a group of friends, reading and writing a lot. So in one way or another, the versions of that life continue to be available. Of course, now what everyone says, you know, oh, London is so expensive, and it is. Back then, I guess I should also add that London was not just cheaper, but there was a whole economy of cheapness and discounts for the unemployed that was there to support you. So it was a lovely safety net, and any slight economic hardship was much more than compensated for by the incredible luxury of having all this time on my hands, you know. So big deal. It was no skin off my nose at all if I wasn't taking taxes, you know. I was going to say that was a small sacrifice to be made in the face of having all this time, but actually it wasn't any kind of sacrifice at all.
So what sort of tipped you over to the point where you thought, well, I don't need that financial support anymore because I'm making money from my writing?
Yeah.
Was that the reviews?
Yeah, that's right. Writing reviews, writing more reviews. And then crucially as well, I got this really lovely job at a publisher where you would go in 2 days a week to be a reader. And it turns out at this particular publisher, Jonathan Cape, there was a long tradition of writers who were employed as readers. And a 2-day-a-week job, of course, is a lovely thing because it means you've still got spare time. I mean, you've got slightly less spare time, and that has that has advantages because it makes you value your time. I felt that's when life really acquired a good balance between having free time and a measure of financial security.
So you published your first book in 1986, which was Ways of Telling, about John Berger. And you've said that you regretted the way that you'd written it almost immediately after it was published. Would you talk a bit about what happened there and how it shaped what you wrote next?
Yeah, so I think it was in about 1983 or 1984 that I met John Berger to interview him for Marxism Today. And, you know, he was my favourite writer, and then he turned into being such a sort of wonderful man, and it was the beginning of a lifelong friendship, and a very important one for me, in that there are so many examples of people, you know, young would-be writers or artists meeting the writer or artist they most admire, and then the writer turns out to be a jerk, you know, and it's all disillusioning. Whereas Berger was just so wonderful from the first moment I met him, and so that was great. And then I agreed to write this book about him, for which I received an advance of £1,000. And then, I mean, several things happened. One, the publisher Pluto went into receivership about 3 or 4 days before I was meant to receive my first copy of the book. So that was a crushing blow, because, I mean, it's difficult to sort of it needs to be emphasized, I think, that there you are, you're somebody who's, I've been writing stuff in papers, but that magical moment when you're going to be transformed from a sort of would-be writer to somebody who's got a published book, I mean, that's such a huge totemic transformational moment. And you and then instead of having this book, which was going to be the proof that I was a published writer, instead I got a thing saying the company's gone into receivership. So that sucked. And then anyway, the book did come out a little bit later. But then as soon as it did come out and I got this validation of the fact that I was some kind of writer, I realized what a unbelievably boring and inadequate book it was, because I hadn't taken advantage of any of the freedoms that Berger had made available. And I just kind of subjected him to this kind of sub-academic processing that what he'd been doing was such a counter to. And so there'd been the disillusionment of the disappointment of the publishing experience. And then there was the more personal disillusionment or internalized disillusionment, I should say, where I realized that it was a thoroughly inadequate book. The only good thing about that was that it got that kind of thing out of my system. And I would say that from then on, to put it rather grandly, a bit like Nietzsche abandoning his dreary academic job as a philologist, from then on, I felt able to embark on a life of properly independent independent writing.
Yeah. I mean, you have a very distinctive voice as a writer. Do you think that that first experience, that first sort of misstep with that book, helped you then find and develop your voice?
I just realized what a way, you know, it's quite a lot of, even writing a boring book takes quite a lot of time and requires quite a lot of energy. So I sort of realized that, I'd sort of put that behind me. And if I had some lingering academic insecurity, then, you know, I felt, oh, well, maybe that's the equivalent of a PhD and I don't need to bother with that stuff anymore. And I think there was some kind of freedom to put that behind me. And although, Hattie, thank you for saying this thing about the voice, and I think I do have a voice, but I think there's another paradox at work here, which is that I was so besotted by Berger and his style of writing that in a way it took me a good long while to I got rid of the academic, sub-academic thing easily, but I think the Berger influence lingered on for a while longer, and I had to work my way through that to become authentically myself, which is to say writing in a voice that was much funnier, because Berger, great writer though he is, obviously I think we'd all agree he's not a funny writer, so maybe my besottedness with Berger actually sort of almost impeded my arrival at my own, that aspect of my own voice.
You've written four novels, but most of your books have been non-fiction. And I was interested to learn that you don't follow the standard publishing route of putting together a proposal before you sell, you know, in order to sell the book. Do you generally still manage to sell the book in advance of having written it, or do you present it to the publisher as a done deal and sell it once you've already written it?
Yeah, the latter, with a few exceptions. So, you know, for example, the book about the aircraft carrier, that was a one-off commission or opportunity that came my way. And similarly, the book about Gary Winogrand, that was something that someone proposed to me and I wanted to do it. But if it's the typical way of proceeding now, which I have complete sort of faith in, is that the way to publish unpublishable books is not to do a proposal, but to just go ahead and write them. And I feel very, very sure that this works for me. And maybe it's one of the reasons why some published non-fiction books are, well, you know, they read like what they are. That is to say, they are a version of the proposal written out in longhand, as it were. Whereas I feel, for a start, why do I do this? Well, because of inadequacy, I'm unable to write a proposal. I haven't got the patience to do it. I hate writing anything that's designed to sell something. And I've become really conscious of something in some highly regarded works of nonfiction. A rather horrible quality I note in the introduction. The introduction, increasingly in nonfiction books, serves as a kind of pitch to the reader. So having pitched the proposal to the publisher, now they're recycling the proposal in the form of an introduction to pitch it to the reader. And I can't bear that. And I just can't do it. And what I really like doing, though, I can't do that, but I like the form of the book, the nature of the book, just to emerge in the writing of it. And then when I've done that and it's all done, then, I mean, I'm a publisher's dream, really, because then I offer them this book and they can make their mind up about it with no risk at all, because, you know, there's no uncertainty. There it is. It's complete. You know, they don't have to sort of have a meeting and say, you know, oh, do you think he's, you know, is he, you know, what's it going to be like? It's there, I mean, with nothing, no hidden risks at all. And then at some point, somebody will hopefully publish it. And the same goes for writing articles as well, in that I know that when you're starting off as a writer, you don't get stuff commissioned. They say send it in on spec because, you know, that's a way of palming you off. And increasingly, I mean, just with articles, I've ended up just writing things and then send them off. And it's especially important if what you're doing is very personal, and from the proposal, the only reasonable response from a publisher would be to say no, because it's just not viable. And I just found that's it's also a good thing to write these things without any regard to what other people's expectations might be. I'll give you a tiny example of this. So I read Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry, and it was just a huge reading experience for me. And so, as happens when you have any big experience, you want to articulate it. So I wrote a little thing about this reading Lonesome Dove. Then this little thing kept growing and growing. And then I ended up with 5,000 words on Larry McMurtry. And at that point, he hadn't had the good grace to die, which would have been a convenient hook. And there was no anniversary in sight. So, you know, I've got this thing which I'd really, it had been very satisfying to write, but it was pretty, you know, the number of places that are going to take a 5,000 word essay on, you know, on a book published however many years ago with no anniversary, pretty small. But anyway, the TLS thankfully published that. So it's, one way or another, if a piece is any good, it will it will see the light of day somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it helps that obviously your reputation and your publishing history and, you know, the fact that you have an audience must help in terms of, I'm sure if the TLS get an email from you, they're going to open the email and read the 5,000 words. But you've earned that.
Yes, and I have been doing something like this for a long while. And I guess with regard to the audience, I mean, this is something that I've been conscious of for a while, and I'm still not sure whether it's just I'm just trying to turn a bad situation into a good one, whereby, you know, I've sort of gone from writing one book about one subject in one style to something completely different. And you know, I mean, typically you hear somebody, you have this idea of the, you know, what they call in this dreadful phrase in the film world, a passion project, that somebody does a number of stupid superhero films, and then on the basis of that, they become bankable enough to do their passion project. The passion project, of course, is often every bit as stupid as the superhero films, it turns out. So that's the model, if you like. You gain a kind of economic base, and then you go on to do your individual thing. But I think as often as not, it works against that, because you become, for all sorts of reasons, dependent on that those sort of big selling things. And I found that I was able to achieve a measure of independence, or so I've convinced myself, by virtue of a prehistory, not of success, but of failure, whereby because the previous books had sold so badly, there was such a small audience for them, it didn't make a toss to anybody whether I did more of the same at a very low level or did something at a similarly low level that was completely different. So weirdly, I just had this sort of freedom that was born out of not having an audience. So I was able to do these different things really quite selfishly with only one person in mind, namely me.
I think that's a modest spin on it, but I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. But it might also have just been a post whatever way of trying to find some advantage in or some good outcome to what had seemed at the time a sort of history of serial flops.
Going back to your voice as a writer, I think what's really unique, and probably me saying this is very ununique, and I'm sure a million other people have already said it, but it's the combination of your tone, which sounds almost quite nonchalant and quite sort of conversational, almost as though you're spontaneously having these thoughts as you're going along. But then there's clearly very diligent research behind your books. It's very obvious reading it that you're extremely well read and that you're consuming a lot of culture and digesting it. What is your relationship with research?
I never do any research. I mean, and I say that, I sort of say that honestly, because, you know, it never feels like research, but I've always had a lot of things that I'm interested in finding out about. So, you know, let's go way back to the jazz book, which came out, first of all, in 1991. Yeah, I really found out a lot about jazz because I loved it so much. Not for a single moment did it ever feel in the process of this finding out that I was researching anything.
Yeah.
Certainly there was no method to it. It just felt really, it felt much. I think anyone who's got a hobby never feels like they're doing research. And I feel I've had a lot of sort of hobbies and interests, and they continue. And at certain points, that pursuing these interests, which I might be generally interested in something, or I might have a very specific interest. Well, the kind of process of inquiry and finding out becomes more focused. But that's what it always just feels like. Pursuing an interest, really, and it's always very haphazard. And I guess also it's you know, I'm quite old now. I'll be 65 this year, and I teach on the writing program at this university. So I've got access to their library, their online library, and I've never got the hang of using libraries, either old-fashioned reference libraries like the Bodleian or online libraries. So I'm just really I'm in a double position, double bind, whereby I don't know how to efficiently research things myself, certainly not online. I even struggle to get access to the free university link to the New York Times. So there's that. And equally, unlike, say, somebody who's the writer of history books who will have research assistants, I'm the only person who can serve as a research assistant for me is actually me myself. So I'm just in this, yeah. So I've become accustomed to my, at home with my rather hobbled or hobbled and haphazard way of finding out about things that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
And it feeds so directly into the writing that whereas the research phase, the idea of research always feels a little bit separate to the writing, for me the two are just so closely woven in with each other, let's say.
That sounds very satisfying. Your books are also structured in a way that their structure is almost concealed from the reader. So I sort of feel like when I'm reading one of your books that I don't know where you're going, but I feel confident that you know where you're going. I wondered how you, do you have any method for sort of planning out the structure of a book, or how do you manage that?
Well, thank you again, Hattie. I mean, I really do feel that structure is one of my strengths, which is why it's so irritated me so mightily with the recent Federer book, that quite a few of the reviews said that it was an unstructured mess. It was so galling because it's a beautifully structured book. Yeah, I like doing structure, and I reckon sort of something like 50% of the cognitive effort of the books has gone into the structure. I rarely have an idea at the outset of the structure, but at some point, and it varies either early on or much later on, some latent possibility in the material or some way of structuring it will emerge that is uniquely appropriate to the material, and it sort of emerges, and when I get a sense of that, then life gets to be much easier, because I'm simultaneously adding to what's there and shaping it at the same time. This book that I'm doing at the moment about my childhood, I had the idea very early on that it would be a map, and it's and so, well, what's happening is actually it's maybe that initial framework is proving to be a slight problem. So whether it will remain a map or not, I don't know. But that was an idea I did have right at the outset, actually.
I'm interested to hear you say that the reviews annoyed you. Do you read all your reviews?
Oh, not all of them, but in a typical narcissistic way, I'm always in the market for praise, and then I'm always, you know, you start reading something thinking, oh, this will be nice, I'll get a nice stroke here, and then I realise, oh my God, it's not a stroke, I'm in receipt of, it's a headbutt, and my nose is streaming blood. So yeah, I don't like that at all, but particularly with this last book, I was really surprised, really, by not just the fact that people didn't like the book, but by how vehemently people were sort of against it. And you know, there's several things going on here. You could say that the author is necessarily is blind to the faults that were so obvious to the reader. Well, that's one way of looking at it. But I was really my sort of sense of the of it was entire of the book was entirely unaltered by all of the adverse comments about it. Yeah, my good opinion of it emerged unscathed.
Oh, I'm really glad to hear that. I think that's the important thing. If you're happy with it,
I was going to say, actually, in a way, I really felt actually sort of I emerged from it feeling weirdly, unlike, you know, Hardy, who famously said that the response to Jude cured him of novel writing for good. I emerged with sort of feeling more confident than ever as a result of some of the stick that I'd taken.
Good for you. my next question that I wanted to ask you is a bit of a sort of wild card, I suppose. But you've written a lot about recreational drugs over the course of your writing career and your experiences with hallucinogens and your enjoyment of smoking weed and all of that. I just wondered, have you written on drugs, and how have you found drugs to affect writing?
Yeah. Oh, there's that wonderful bit in the introduction to the Thomas Pynchon collection, Slow Learner, where I think he talks about marijuana, and there's maybe it's a bracket or a clause, and he says, that useful substance. And for many years, it really was so useful for me in terms of the kind of uninhibited outpouring of ideas and stuff like that, of not being too sort of clenched and uptight and sort of editing yourself as you go along. And even before then, I mean, so that's a way of, yeah, it's I mean, that was very helpful. But I think even before then, quite often, I'd be having an experience, and it was the fact that I was under the influence of some sort of drug that made that experience seem potentially worth writing about. So in every way, my experience of this was positive. And I think in a way, I mean, I feel I was in some sort of classic sort of romantic tradition there. You know, some of these kind of experiences, they were like Wordsworth's spots of time, but in adult life. And I wanted to preserve them in print, and yeah, so from LSD through to sort of marijuana, it was all just wonderful and great. And then, I mean, I've written about this before, but then at a certain point, it sort of stopped working for me, and I think that was bound up with this thing. I was living in London, and then, as people know, you know, this kind of great change occurred in the marijuana market, where it stopped having any relation at all, it seemed, to the drug I used to like, and just became this kind of this conduit, this thing that seemed like more like kind of a traumatic head injury, and it was just too strong. And weirdly, so you might think, okay, it's just stronger, therefore I can use less to get the same effect. And that's nice, because, of course, the experience of smoking was always so vile to me. But it seemed it wasn't just a thing of quantity. It seemed the whole nature of the experience was different. And it wasn't one it wasn't one I enjoyed. And two, it just didn't seem to be doing anything for me at all creatively. And so it's just followed this lot. Sort of long and entirely easy withdrawal from using marijuana stopped being useful to me at all, to my considerable surprise and disappointment, because I thought it would be something that would always work for me.
Well, it sounds like you've had wonderful experiences with it, more wonderful than I ever have. maybe I'll give it another go.
I think it's not, and I think, as with all so many things, you know, what I've described as my personal experience turns out that it's quite, you know, there's probably quite a lot of actuarial data supporting this kind of thing, because it turns out nearly everything you do in your life, you think it's all about you, and then it turns out all you're doing is just riding some typical demographic wave. So it's all pretty normal stuff, I think.
Going back to the writing, Is there anything that you find particularly challenging as a writer?
Yes, getting going on things, I find that really difficult. And then I think I've, in terms of fiction writing, I guess, you know, I think I've always struggled with dialogue, actually. It's never various writers I've come across saying, you know, yeah, that dialogue comes easily to them. I think it hasn't to me. Those would be the things I'm conscious of, really. And also, I guess, in terms of fiction, of being, obviously, I've got a very wide range of books on different topics. But when it comes to fiction, I mean, fiction really brings you face to face with your limitations. And I'm aware of just what a kind of limited canvas I operate within as a fiction writer. The settings vary, but it's pretty much always the same. It's kind of group of friends, party, boy meets girl, you know, that kind of, that's about it, really.
But each of us can only write about, well, maybe there are exceptions to this, but I feel like everybody has their sort of stomping ground in terms of fictional ideas. And much as I might like to be writing something that would feel really cutting edge in 2023, the likelihood is that if I write a novel, it'll probably be about a woman who's a bit like me.
That's the thing with writing, that it's a question of you know, arriving at a way of writing that that works for you. So, for example, I mean, if we think of, you know, a writer I really love, Tessa Hadley, I mean, I think one of the reasons I love reading her is because, I mean, she's highly intelligent, obviously. Now, how does that intelligent manifest itself, or how does it fit? Well, it fits absolutely within all of the demands that a novel makes on the writer. There's just a, she is just a, it seems to me, she's just a novelist to the, you know, from the tips of her toes to the hair on her head kind of thing. And then there might be, you might be a different kind of writer like me, whereby, well, you know, no, it's not quite, there's it's not quite fitting into that. There's all sorts of stuff I want to do that is not tailored for that particular form of writing. But you can find other forms that are entirely appropriate for you and everything you want to say and how you want to say it.
Do you remember any moments over the years where you had a sort of breakthrough moment, or somebody gave you a piece of advice about writing that really clicked something for you?
I think it was more gradual than that, but we come back once again to John Berger. And, you know, when I'd left university, literature for me meant, well, either poetry or fiction, really. And it was the problem with writing fiction is that I'd never been able to think of any stories. So what did that leave me to be? Well, a critic. And then the discovery of John Berger was so important, because there was this way of writing that he was demonstrating, which was both creative and critical. It was both imaginative, and it was a form of commentary. And this was, you know, this made a space, he made me aware of a space where I could very comfortably operate. But as is so often the case with breakthrough moments or turning points, this was actually a gradual realization. It took a while for me to realize to make good on that opportunity that he'd afforded. It wasn't at all a sort of eureka moment like that, but I think that would be the decisive exposure to something that made a path available to me.
And The Last Days of Roger Federer is partly about how, or perhaps mainly about how, people grapple with the end of their working lives. Do you have a sense of what an ideal ending to your working life would look like?
Well, not really, but I'm curious to find out. And one of the it can take many forms, and, you know, I'm really conscious now in a way that that I wasn't when I was younger, that you know, just as I'm, you know, I'm playing tennis in about an hour and a half, and I'm already thinking, yeah, I better start doing my shoulder warm-up exercises, all this kind of stuff, if I, you know, in a way that I'd never used to worry about before. And so, you know, I'm conscious that my brain isn't, you know, can't recover now from the kind of alcoholic pounding that I used to give it the night before starting off on writing. So there's all of this kind of thing, and I'm sort of curious to see what will happen in my creative life. But the great thing is, though, that I realise now I think it's really unfortunate if people are forced out of their writing life, their creative lives, circumstantially, because they just can't afford to do it, or whatever goes wrong. So I feel that it'll just be dependent on what's going on with me internally, and what I have left to say. And I promise you, I'm as interested in that as anyone. In fact, the truth is, I'm probably more interested in it than anyone else. I might even be the only person interested in it.
I think if you can head towards later life feeling that curiosity, that's probably the best state you could be in. It's, I mean, curiosity is a lot better than dread, isn't it?
But of course, I mean, I think it's quite unusual to get to my age and not have this dread. And I think we all have the same dread, which is the Iris Murdoch syndrome, this dread of, you know, you can become, you know, I'm sort of conscious of the, you know, what we, yeah, we, there's this dread of dementia, of the
yes,
brain packing in. And, you know, there's there is that, which also, that has the effect of imparting a kind of, not exactly urgency, but yeah, just, you know, really, you're really conscious that there are some things, I'm conscious that there are some things I want to do, and there isn't all the time in the world to do them. But that's quite a healthy thing. It's a mature version of the impatience that used to assail me when I was younger.
Yeah. And looking at your writing life specifically, what do you feel most proud of?
Oh, I think having just been, not so much proud of, but I feel very glad that I've been able to lead it, really. I mean, I've written more books than I ever sort of thought I would, and that's been a source of it's made my life better for me. It's been, in every way, I've been invited to more parties, and I've been kept happier as a result of it. So at every level, it's been a good thing. There hasn't been a single downside to it, I don't think.
Thank you so much to Jeff Dyer. His latest book is The Last Days of Roger Federer and Other Endings. I would also really recommend Out of Sheer Rage. I'm going to put links to both of those in the episode notes, but you can also go to the In Writing shop at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing and find several of his books there, which is also a way of supporting this podcast. A reminder before we go that I have an exclusive discount code for the Writing School Curtis Brown Creative. So use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. If you're enjoying the podcast, which I really hope you are, I'm enjoying it, and you want to support it, then sharing it or leaving a review on your chosen podcast app are wonderful ways to do that. That's all from me this week. See you next time.